This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Since World War II, studies have shown that soldiers who encounter the heaviest combat or who have extended or multiple deployments are at higher risk of developing war-related problems. Social worker Ray Mansour Scurfield says it's a lesson that's gone unheeded, given that men and women serving in Iraq and Afghanistan are being deployed more than once and having their deployments extended. This is a lesson that needs attention. Scurfield notes that a report by the Army Surgeon General indicated that 30% of U.S. troops returning from the Iraq War have developed stress-related mental health problems 3 to 4 months after coming home. Scurfield is a veteran of Vietnam and the Department of Veterans Affairs. He's the author of a trilogy of books on the impact of war, and he is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. The trilogy is called A Vietnam Trilogy. The third book in the trilogy is War Trauma, Lessons Unlearned from Vietnam to Iraq. The first volume, Veterans and Post-Traumatic Stress, 1968, 1989, and 2000. It was followed by Healing Journeys, Study Abroad with Vietnam Veterans. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon with questions, comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. In the mid to late 1960s, Ray Scurfield served 4 years on active duty in Vietnam, including 1 year as a social work officer on an Army psychiatric team. He is currently an associate professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Southern Mississippi Gulf Coast. He is well known for his expertise in war-related post-traumatic stress disorder. His most recent publications are on the psychological impacts of the events of September 11th and Hurricane Katrina. A Vietnam Trilogy is published by Algora, which is an on-demand print publisher. The numbers, again, if you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Ray Scurfield, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. This idea of lessons unlearned, it strikes me as being really disconcerting, because shouldn't the military and the Department of Veterans Affairs, shouldn't we be striving, how to better address the needs of soldiers and veterans in the wake of a conflict?
That would seem to be a totally, obvious situation. It's just amazing how far back this goes, but it seems like there are a lot of powerful forces that want to minimize or deny the impact, the negative impact of war on people who participate in it, because it has very extraordinary budget implications, moral implications, etc. And as an example of how far, when I worked in VA Central Office in 1982 to 85, and we were starting to talk about PTSD then, there were a number of people there who were very pro-military, but they really weren't pro-veteran. They oftentimes felt that the money that was being asked for veterans programs would compete with the money that was wanted to fund, if you will, the war machine. And as a result, we had things like people feeling that PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, was an anti-war concept, that somehow if you emphasize too much the problems of people coming back from war, that this would somehow undermine the willingness of our young people to come to the defense of their country when they were asked. And so the prejudices have been around for many years, and they have political and economic bases to them.
Hmm. What's needed to break down these impediments to proper care for soldiers and veterans?
That's an excellent question. It seems to me that you have to have better oversight, because the institutions themselves tend to downplay or deny the extent of the problems. They also tend to, as we are seeing now, and they happened before, they tend to deny that they need more resources. They tend to say, we can take care of the problem, and then you get behind the curve, and then there's a long delay. And I quite frankly don't think that we can generally trust that the leaders will tell us the truth about how well-equipped or ill-equipped they are to deal with current, let alone, impending problems that may be coming along. And that's exactly what's happened with returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, is that they're coming back to systems that are already overloaded with what they had already been taken care of. What is an oversight that's really going to do the job? Because we have an additional problem. There seems to be selective amnesia after every war is gone for a few years, where people seem to forget about this. And then when the new war comes along, these organizations don't get geared up adequately, and no one puts pressure on them sufficiently for them to be ready. So, to me, one of the oversights is that the congressional oversight, to me, is too issue-oriented. It pops up when there is a major brouhaha, like, you know, the Walter Reed fiasco, mm-hmm. and then you have oversight, or you get a time-limited commission of some type. And these tend to be short-lived, and then eventually they are disbanded, and then the organizations go back to doing business as usual.
Where are we now in that cycle in terms of how Walter Reed is handling the veteran situation and how other veterans' hospitals are serving or not serving the needs of vets?
Well, I'm not in the Department of Veterans Affairs any longer. I've been teaching at a university since 98, so my contact is very indirect, and it's through, you know, different people that I know and what I read in the newspapers like everyone else. But clearly, Walter Reed was just the tip of the iceberg. I think that it's too easy to blame Walter Reed when indeed it's the system. For example, there's what's called medical hold, and that's where, you know, someone is injured or wounded in on active duty, and their condition is serious enough that they're probably going to be processed out of the military. Well, and they're having their wounds and injuries attended to. They are put into this limbo status, and it can go on for months. And I've been told that many of the medical hold facilities around the country tend to be the oldest and facilities, and they tend to not be in very good condition, and that these folks are generally languishing in this limbo between active duty and getting discharged. So I don't know to what extent that has been improved around the country. I'm sure it's been improved at Walter Reed because the spotlight's right there.
Yeah. The figure I quoted in my introduction from the Army Surgeon General, which comes from your book, Lessons Unlearned from Vietnam to Iraq, 30% of veterans coming back from Iraq developing stress-related mental health problems 3 to 4 months after coming home. How many veterans are we talking about then?
Well, what is the number have been deployed? The last figure I knew of was about 1.5 million have been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. I believe that number is probably higher now. So
hundreds of thousands.
So, oh yes, you're 1/3 would be 500,000, and the figures are, you know, 30% is a. Different studies, some show 15%, Some show 35%. The figures vary, but putting them all together from World War II onward, it looks like clearly at least 15% and up to well over 30% can be expected as a course of what happens when you're in war.
Hmm. How does that compare with Vietnam?
I do need to emphasize that Vietnam is the only era of service that there ever was a national psychiatric epidemiologic study. In other words, a study that didn't just look at people who come into clinics or people who are being treated, but it surveyed a random sample of the entire population of Vietnam veterans. That is the only way that you can come up with national incidence and prevalence statistics. Okay, you can't do samples of people in hospitals or how many people come to the VA and have that generalized to the total population of veterans, because that is not representative of who's out there, the people who come in. So the only era that we can, with any degree of certainty, talk about the prevalence of post-traumatic stress and other problems is the Vietnam era, because our country has not seen fit to fund national prevalence studies of any other era whatsoever. So having said that, in Vietnam, the study by the called the National Vietnam Veteran Readjustment Study, which came out in about 1988. So that's like, 13 to 15 years after the end of the Vietnam War, found that some 30% of Vietnam vets had a lifetime prevalence of PTSD. In other words, that means that at some time since the war, they met all the criteria for a full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder. And those who were wounded had a even a little higher incidence, or excuse me, prevalence of post-traumatic stress. So every other era is guesswork, basically, as to how many.
And in Iraq and Afghanistan, soldiers who suffer major traumatic physical injury are surviving wounds that would have been fatal in past conflicts. So I am supposing here that these soldiers are at a greater risk of developing PTSD.
Yes. As a matter of fact, in my second book, Healing Journeys, one of the chapters is about the trials and tribulations that occur from the moment you're wounded in battle until all the things that you have to go through before you end up getting stabilized and start recuperating back stateside. There are just so many issues and challenges for people with severe physical injuries that naturally demand the attention of most care providers and of most family members and of most veterans, because, of course, you're trying to save lives, save limbs, and so forth. And so the emotional aspects tend to get short thrift, and they tend to be sort of pushed aside until later.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's understandable, though, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's understandable, but that's no excuse not to understand that that goes on and to then have programs in place to try to deal with it later.
Hmm. Are there differences in the trauma-related problems of vets from different wars, different conflicts?
There can be. One of the most dominant variables is, was it a, if you will, a conventional war, such as World War II, where the enemy dressed up in uniforms, we both were on different sides, and it was very clear who was enemy and who was civilian and who was not, by and large, and typically the enemy were males, adult males, and so you had adult males fighting adult males, and that on one level is much easier for combatants to deal with, because else. But then you had such as Vietnam, and as is the case in Iraq and Afghanistan, you have what's called guerrilla warfare, or it's called insurgent or terrorist warfare, where enemy does not dress up, enemy does not announce that they are out to get you, and the enemy also are often mostly from the country in which you are fighting. And so the ability to tell friend from foe, or to tell who's in between and is neither friend nor foe, becomes extraordinarily difficult. And you then have to make split-second decisions that end up with people getting killed and maimed, because you have to decide in split seconds, is this a foe, or is this mm-hmm. someone who just doesn't understand,
mm-hmm.
And they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the longer the battles go on, the more likely you're going to err on the side of killing and shooting first rather than having more of your comrades hurt. And then what happens is then a lot of people, you may never know if they were innocent or not, who oftentimes are adult males, but oftentimes they're adult females, they're children, they're the elderly, end up becoming increasing casualties in the war. And I have found over the years that the killing and maiming of children, women, and the elderly is particularly difficult for American military personnel to be able to stomach and justify to themselves later.
Yeah. Well, that raises an obvious and important question. How do you get through it?
Yes, it's very problematic. One of the problems is that how do you train? You have to understand how you are trained in the first place and what happens. Because what happens is that there's a tactic used, which I'll use the phrase dehumanizing the enemy. And you learn this in basic training, and you have this inculcated in you, and it's reinforced in the war zone. And by dehumanizing the enemy, you are told that they are not like us. They are not normal human beings. They don't cherish family. Their beliefs are twisted as far as religion, etc. And, of course, there's always some truth to some of these things. But by and large, you then learn to not see the enemy as human. And that makes it easier to kill them. And as long as you can maintain that, you're able to live better with what things that you had to do. But it's when the realization hits that these really are people like us. They do care about their families, and so forth, that it then can be. And then on top of that, if you believe in the virtue of the war you're fighting, that gives you another thing that can help you to get through what you have to do, because you believe that this is just and it's for the right cause. To the degree that you believe that, that helps to be somewhat of an antidote to whatever you have to do. Not mm-hmm. necessarily totally, but at least some.
Yeah.
But then if you start disbelieving or having very ambivalent feelings about the morality or the worthiness or the need for the war you're fighting, then you get caught up in those issues that maybe I was doing something that was immoral or didn't need to be done, etc. And so then you bring those things home with you. And while you're still in the war zone, typically you can protect yourself from those feelings because you're caught up in survival. But then when you get back, it's days, weeks, months, years later that those things can start then intruding on all of the rationales and reasons that you have put in your mind as to why it was okay to do what you did. Mm-hmm. And then if you start having doubts about that, you then have a long healing process because you're then dealing with issues of morality and guilt. A lot of guilt and feeling responsible for unnecessary deaths. And so this is it takes quite a while for a number of people to be able to heal from.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Raymond Mansour Scorefield. He's an associate professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Southern Mississippi Gulf Coast. He's a veteran of Vietnam and the Department of Veterans Affairs, and he's the author of a trilogy of books on the impact of war. And he is our guest this afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now, a listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Do we have any statistics at all on the prevalence of post-traumatic syndrome among civilians in the war zone, which in the case of Iraq would be all of Iraq?
Yeah.
That's an excellent point. The short answer is I don't know of any. There may have been some organizations, international from other countries, that have tried I think I remember reading about at least one survey like that, and I can't remember what it said. But actually, your point hits home to a very critical point, which is that the welfare and what happens to the civilians in countries that we're fighting in almost never is part of the issue as far as are we winning the war or not, are we doing things properly, etc. It pretty much is, you know, are we, of course, killing the enemy and so forth. And the civilian casualties tend to be seen as, one phrase used is, collateral damage. And, which is a very chilling phrase. To put it another way, I don't think that the numbers of people who are killed who are civilians or who are wounded psychologically has ever impacted on the kind of war that we're fighting and whether we're going to stay there or not.
If, as some of the military people are talking about this now, that we would be there for 40 years, and if the pattern follows that of the British occupation of continued insurgency, it would seem to me this would have a devastating impact upon the society.
I can't imagine that it wouldn't. To me, the part of the problem is that occupiers, foreign military occupiers who go into another country might initially, as we were, be welcomed as saviors, etc. But throughout history, the longer that a foreign nation occupies, no matter what you call it, that they have military troops in another country, inevitably they become despised and hated by a growing number of the indigenous population. Just imagine if it would happen here in the U.S. What would happen if we had Russia or pick somebody who had troops here and they stayed for 10, 15 years. It's just an inevitable part of the process.
It would seem that there would have to be an extreme dehumanizing effort on the part of the occupying force, that they would have to, in a long-term occupation, consider the people they are controlling as less than human. And to me, it seems much more understandable today what happened with the German occupation of European nations than it ever was before.
Yes, it is extraordinarily difficult to try to maintain one's humanity when you're in a foreign country and you have this range of people there who on one side, some people who may genuinely are glad you're there, to people in the middle who aren't going to take sides on either side because they're too vulnerable, and then people on the other side of it who consider you to be the vermin and less than human. And then when it's a non-conventional warfare, you truly don't know if that person who's cutting your hair or selling you something in a shop or is walking up to you alongside a road is enemy in between or friendly. And when that happens day after day after day, what do you do? What do you have to do to protect yourself and your comrades and yet somehow try to maintain a humanity towards the other, towards the civilians? It's extraordinarily difficult.
Somehow war seems much less likely to be a solution than some of our leaders have tried to tell us, that it is justifiable to go much farther with diplomatic initiatives rather than preemptive warfare. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for those comments.
Well, let's take another call now. Listener on a cell phone, line 2. Good afternoon.
Yeah, so I would just like to approach the issue that you're talking about, the occupying forces. You know, we still have troops in Germany and Europe, and we have troops in South Korea. I don't know where you guys come with this. I mean, we've had troops from World War II clear up till now in Germany. I mean, why are you so hung up on this? I mean, it's just... it's amazing that you try to take this and turn it into a different political advantage. But, you know, fact is, we have troops all over the world stationed here. And they're, you know, if you want to call them occupying forces, you can call them occupying forces, too. So I don't see any difference. The only difference is we're at war with these people. And if when you're at war with people, you have to destroy them. And I'd like to have your comment, please. Thank you.
Well, you make a good point. I think we are particularly talking about when you are at war. Places like South Korea and Germany, you know, their governments and a lot of their people have accepted us being there as a countervailing power force for other threats that they might perceive. In the case of Korea, obviously from North Korea. And I would argue that those countries... are much more negotiating partners with us after the hostilities are over. We have the problem in Iraq and Afghanistan of it's very unclear as to who is the government, who does the government represent, and so it's a quite unstable situation where essentially our forces are carrying the day militarily. That is not the case in Korea, Germany, etc., where we're one of, you know, they have their own powerful military. But I don't want to make this a political issue, though we can certainly put it that way. I'm just trying to emphasize that when you're in the middle of hostilities in a war that is not a conventional war, you are caught up in all of these sectarian and so forth issues that are going on in the country, and you do end up invariably being considered an occupier by a number of the people there. And I know that even in South Korea, there are a number of South Koreans who don't want the American forces there. But apparently a majority of the people do, so we are there. But it's not a simplistic answer, but overall, when the hostilities are continuing as they are and the local and the country does not have a clear and established majority government with the majority of the people behind it, I think you are left as an occupier.
Hmm. That caller raises a question that's an important one, I think, and that is, how does the political climate and popular support for a war affect soldiers and veterans?
Yeah, that's an extremely important point. And actually, I want to first make one point. I really don't care if someone is for or against the war in Iraq or Afghanistan regarding the issue of does being in war have an injurious impact on many people who participate in it. Clearly, though, a majority of veterans years later will tell you that they thought that their military experience was more positive than negative. Clearly, a majority of veterans will tell you that the war, that they feel good about what they did, and so forth. It's a substantial minority who are impacted otherwise. But a substantial minority of up to 30% or so is a quite a large number, but it does not absolutely represent the majority, but it's a substantial minority. Having said that, when we're overseas, and I can remember, I used to get the L.A. Times. I ordered the Sunday L.A. Times, and it would arrive about 6 weeks late in Vietnam. And you'd be reading about anti-war protesters and so forth. And this really hurts. I mean, because you feel like you're over there and you're being stabbed in the back. You're in the middle of survival. And now we have instant communications, and everyone knows what's going on back here in terms of all the debates and cutting off funding and should there be an ending date. And these can't help but have a dramatic impact on our forces overseas. Another piece of it is that you really, when you're in the war zone, even if you're against the war, you're not going to speak out about that very much because you're not going to be very popular in the middle of a war. And so there really isn't free expression that goes on in the war. In the war zone, you're there to carry out the mission, and you've got to carry out the mission, whatever your mission is, and you've got to be single-focused about that, or more people are going to die. So typically, you're caught up in that in a survival sense, and it's not until after you get back and how you're received back days and weeks and months later, that's when it can really hurt. For example, I've had Vietnam veterans tell me that they were told by their friends, it's a shame you had to lose a limb or had to have this happen to you for no reason at all, for nothing good. It was all a waste. The communists took over the country anyway, that kind of thing. And so if the war in Iraq turns out not to be what was the premise that helped for us to go in the first place, if it turns out that the country is destabilized after we leave, and if radicals end up taking over whole or parts of it, there will be many people probably saying that we shouldn't have been there in the first place. It was a mistake. We didn't make things better. We might have made it worse. And then to the degree that the combatants themselves internalize that and have those same beliefs, it's going to make their coping and rationalizations for what they did that much more difficult. Hmm.
Let's take another call, a listener waiting for us in Bartlett, Illinois, on line 4. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I like what this guy is saying, you know, and being in the middle about it. And it's a breath of fresh air. I agree with you on this. And I was thinking as far as this stress and the syndrome you're talking about, I'm an ex-firefighter. I'm retired, and I mean, even firefighters today, and even in some respects, detectives, you know, for murder, suicides, and whatnot, have almost the same thing. And I don't know if you've ever studied that either, but I kind of, with my situation, I would kind of relate that to almost the same as being out in the war. Mm-hmm. And it's basically I can't remember now, but anyway, I feel for a lot of these people that are in these wars, no matter whether it be World War One, World War Two, the Vietnam, or Korea. My dad, for instance, he won't talk about it, and I don't blame him. He should not, you know, he shouldn't have to. But at the same time, everybody enlists and everybody gets drafted, and war is war. And what I can't understand is these people come back from the war, some of them, and that small minority that you were talking about, and complain about it when they signed up full well that someday they may have to do this. regardless of what the politicians say, we're not letting the military run the war. It's a political war, again, just like Vietnam. And until people see that as such and let the military do what they need to do, what they were paid to with their equipment, then it's always going to be a fight. People are going to get blown up, killed. You're going to see it on the nightly news because that's what the news wants to sell you and to make things. And this is where I think the media has gotten off kilter. Unfortunately, you know, all these veterans are going to pay the price when they come back. And God, you know, heaven forbid that we pull out of there and we don't do anything. We don't win this war, because all it's going to do is shame all of our, all the people who died over there. They're going to basically have died for nothing. So,
well, you raised a number of issues here, and we're running down on time, so I'm going to jump in and ask the guests to respond.
Those are many, many issues. I want to quote one line from the movie Ulysses, the more recent movie Ulysses, where Ulysses' friend is talking to him, and he says something like, "War is young men dying and old men talking." It's always been that way. And, of course, now it's young men and women and middle-aged and older men and women dying and old men and women talking. And politics are always part of war, always. And to me, what I'm trying to get people to get is that war is inherently injurious to the mental health or the spiritual health of a significant minority of those who participate, regardless of the war, regardless of how right or wrong you might argue it is, regardless of any factor, war harms a significant minority of people who participate. Does our country recognize that? Do we set up the appropriate resources to help our veterans who and their families who are inevitably going to have this amount of people come back with lifelong hurt? And I believe that our country and our government, by and large, has denied this reality through every war. And as long as that happens, we are never going to have adequate resources to care for those who went into harm's way.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Bloomington on line one. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, thank you. What you said about collective amnesia is very true. There was a book written by two doctors in the 40s called Men Under Stress, and they pretty much pegged it then, and they rewrote the book in the 60s before the Vietnam War. So the information was available but wasn't used. I went to the VA in the 80s for PTSD, and they just threw medication at it and changed your personality and ruined your marriage, but didn't help the problems that you had. The VA has been downsized since the 80s, and what veterans really need is a true advocate. And how can we get that? The politicians aren't doing it. The patient's advocate at the hospitals don't do it, so... when can America give an advocate for veterans? Thanks.
Yes, that book was written by Krinker and Spiegel, I believe, were the authors. The things that they found have been conveniently forgotten. There are many possible suggestions, but one of them that I have suggested is that the congressional delegation in each state, in other words, the U.S. senators and U.S. House of Representatives from each state, that they be held to be primarily accountable to ensure oversight of all the DOD and VA facilities in their respective states. And that this not be a commission, but this be a permanent oversight. And that's just one thing. And I mention that because I believe then they would be more accountable to the electorate, that this is a job that they're supposed to do along with all their other jobs. And I'm going to stop there. We could. There's many
yeah.
more.
Yeah.
I do have on my website. Actually, if you go to my website, I have an actual a number of documents. But one of them is what we can do to try to solve these problems, and it's one of about 10 or 15 documents that you can download if you're interested in reading them.
And you want to give us your website then?
You know, actually, I think the easiest way to get to it is go to Google or Yahoo, my name, Raymond
yeah.
Scurfield,
uh-huh.
Ray Scurfield, S-C-U-R Field. And then when you do that on any engine search, University of Southern Mississippi will come up one of the first couple hits. And that'll take you
yeah.
right to my website.
That's the best approach these days to finding a website is to just to put the key things into the browser and let it do the work. Let's take another call, a listener also in Bloomington, Illinois, this one on line 2. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Hi.
I came in late, so I don't know that I really understand the program as well as I probably should. However, I heard a couple things that I thought were disturbing. One of them was a comparison of the troops coming home from Vietnam to the troops coming home from Iraq. Having lived through both of these, I would have to say that they have almost nothing to do with each other. The veterans are not being scorned like they were in the Vietnam War. America as a whole has a horrid history in the way we treat our warriors. The folks coming home today do not have anywhere near the amount of social stressors put on them that the folks in Vietnam did. Now, the other thing is that, and I may have misheard this, but it seems like the guest was almost pushing towards, let's not have free speech here. Let's not have the folks at home make too much noise about this war because it's going to mess up the troops. Now, I also say that I came in late, so I may
yeah.
have misunderstood that. I had one more point that I wanted to make, and it has totally left my mind, so I'm just going to go ahead and hang up. And thank you very much for having the show.
You're very welcome. It seems that is something we are doing differently. We're greeting the returning soldiers in a different way than what happened during the Vietnam War. That is true.
Yes, what they said during the Vietnam War was people confused the warrior with the war. And so anti-war activists would spit at, call Vietnam vets baby killers, etc. And there has been a definite drive to not have that replicated, starting with the first Persian Gulf War the early 90s and to the current war. So in that regard, the last caller is absolutely right. But the problem is, I am definitely not advocating no free speech. What's happened is that it's been painted by pro-war types that if you criticize the validity of this war or our war effort, then you are hurting our troops. And it's almost like you're put in a catch-22 if you really feel negatively about the war, that you're not supposed to say anything. And so what does that do? That only helps the war to go on. But if you do say something, then you're hurting our troops. And I believe there is some inevitable spillover. However, I absolutely believe that we should be allowing all voices to be heard and to be heard loudly and clearly. And to include the voices of this is what happens when people go to war. This is the cost, the inevitable cost. And are you still willing to support this war when you frankly look at the numbers of Americans who are hurt by this, the numbers of Iraqi and Afghanistan civilians who are hurt by this? Are you still willing to support this war? And if so, that so be it. But I think what's happened is that those kinds of issues are muted, and so people end up going along with a war and not recognizing the full human cost on all sides. And that, to me, is the tragic part.
Yeah. There we have to wrap it up. One more thing I want to go back and clear up, though. We had a listener call in who couldn't stay on the line with us, and he just wanted to make sure, he or she, I don't know, wanted to make sure that they heard correctly. So let's just go back over this statistic real briefly. Of those deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, 1.5 million over the last several years, 500,000, Ray, at risk or experiencing stress-related mental health problems?
I believe the figures from several studies being conducted by the military, by the way, which is a good thing that they've been willing to conduct studies during the war itself. I believe their various studies are anywhere from 15% to over 30% of in the various samples that they've done have some kind of mental health and stress-related difficulties. So you can extrapolate the figures from there. At the upper end, it would be as many as 0.5 million. But I want to emphasize, though, that the acute psychiatric casualty rate always is smaller than the long-term psychiatric casualty rate. Always.
Yeah.
For many reasons.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We'll have to have you back because I would like to talk with you about what you've found in your experience in the way of treatment and counseling that offers relief to veterans suffering the trauma of war. We haven't even touched that topic.
No, we haven't.
So let's make a date for another time, Ray.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, and thank the all of the listeners who felt strongly enough about this to call in.
Yeah. Very good. Raymond Mansour Scurfield has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine, currently an associate professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Southern Mississippi. He's a veteran of Vietnam and the Department of Veterans Affairs. He is the author of a trilogy of books on the impact of war, the latest volume 3 of a Vietnam trilogy, War Trauma, Lessons Unlearned from Vietnam to Iraq. And our guest's name is spelled S. C-U-R-F-I-E-L-D. So if you're interested in learning more about our guest and his area of study, you can put his name into your browser.